tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I'm a trustee of the Philip Larkin Society. Today's episode celebrates what would have been Larkin's 99th birthday and features just Larkin's poetry. I was inspired to do this in part by my conversation with sculptor and Honorary Vice President Martin Jennings when we were recording July's podcast episode. And Martin commented that above all, he wanted to hear more of Larkin's poetry. So this 99th birthday special is just that, Larkin's poems read by a range of contributors, all of whom generously gave up their time to make their recordings and send them to me over the last month. I had so many that I'm going to make this 99th birthday special a two-parter. So today is the first part and the second part will be out in the next week or so. I could have organised these poems in many different ways, such as by chronology, by subject matter, or by collection, but I decided to organise the poems into five themes. Of course, this is then my interpretation of these many and varied poems, and I'm not sure all of you will agree with my choices and ideas. Anyway, we start off with Bitter Resignation and Feeling Awkward, with the section I call The Challenges of Life. We open with Helen Cooper, co-opted trustee and librarian and archivist at Larkin's old school in Coventry, King Henry VIII, with one of Larkin's most famous and quotable poems. And watch out for old friend of the podcast, David Quantick. We also hear the voices of Greg Walker, Wade Newman and Richard Johnston.
This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
Hello, I'm Wade Newman, speaking from New York City. I chose Philip Larkin's poem, The Life with a Hole in It, because it, like so much of Larkin's poetry, ultimately exemplifies his fear of death, but in the course of writing the poem, enables him to stare down the inevitable and thereby control that fear. This poem, like many of Larkin's works, is built on a tight economy of words, meter, and rhyme, which also inspires my own poetry. It, like any Larkin poem, contains an almost deadpan quality that in its subtle climax knocks the wind out of me. The Life with a Hole in It by Philip Larkin. When I throw back my head and howl, people, women mostly, say, but you've always done what you want. You always get your own way. A perfectly vile and foul inversion of all that's been. What the old ratbags mean is, I've never done what I don't. So the shit in the shuttered chateau who does his 500 words, then parts out the rest of the day, between bathing and booze and birds, is far off as ever, but so is that spectacled school-teaching sod, six kids and the wife in pod, and her parents coming to stay. Life is an immobile, locked, three-handed struggle between your wants, the world's for you, and worse, the unbeatable, slow machine that brings what you'll get. Blocked, they strain round a hollow stasis of havings to, fear, faces. Days sip down it constantly. Years.
I'm Greg Walker, a Philip Larkin reader in Falls Church, Virginia, USA. Here's a poem about innocence. First sight. Lambs that learn to walk in snow when their bleating clouds the air meet a vast unwelcome, know nothing but a sunless glare. Newly stumbling to and fro, all they find outside the fold is a wretched width of cold. As they wait beside the ewe, her fleeces wetly caked, there lies hidden round them, waiting to earth's immeasurable surprise. They could not grasp it if they knew what so soon will wake and grow utterly unlike the snow.
Days. What are days for? Days are where we live. They come. They wake us time and time over. They are to be happy in. Where can we live but days? Solving that question brings the priest and the doctor in their long coats, running over the fields.
My name is Richard Johnston, and I'm a professor at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Reasons for Attendance has always been one of my all-time favorite poems by Larkin, and it may have been the first poem by Larkin that I ever read. This would have been, I think, in high school. I remember how the poem's treatment of social and vocational exclusion really resonated with me. Since that time, Reasons for Attendance has become my favorite poem to teach, and just about every semester I love working through the poem with students and helping them see the continuous and multifaceted struggle in the poem, a vocational struggle that emerges as a tension between out here and in there, between dark and light, between age and youth, between singleness and coupledom, between the sound made by a bell and the sound made by a trumpet. Reasons for Attendance. The trumpet's voice, loud and authoritative, draws me a moment to the lighted glass to watch the dancers, all under 25, shifting intently, face to flushed face, solemnly on the beat of happiness. Or so I fancy, sensing the smoke and sweat, the wonderful feel of girls. Why be out here? But then, why be in there? Sex, yes. But what is sex? Surely to think the lion's share of happiness is found by couples, sheer inaccuracy, as far as I'm concerned. What calls me is that lifted rough-tongued bell, art, if you like, whose individual sound insists I, too, am individual. It speaks, I hear. Others may hear as well, but not for me, nor I for them, and so with happiness. Therefore, I stay outside, believing this, and they maul to and fro, believing that, and both are satisfied. If no one has misjudged himself or lied.
This next section, with poems read by Wes Finch, Rachel Gallatly, and Martin Duckworth, deals with life on the margins. Although, as our first reader, Anne Gibson, says, these are also universal truths that Larkin expressed. Falling ill, facing up to death, exploring the side of us all that is at odds with the world, and even with a hint of menace to them, these poems explore the darker side of life.
Hello, my name is Anne Gibson, and I'm a retired academic librarian and a practicing yoga teacher, among other things. I've always loved poetry, having been lucky enough to have had poetry books from a very early age, beginning with Mother Goose's nursery rhymes. I can't really remember when I first came across Larkin, but my love of his poems started in earnest when I was given Wits and Weddings and High Windows back in the late 80s. The poem I'm going to read is The Building, which I discovered relatively recently. The building in question is the Hull Royal Infirmary, which opened in 1967. And I chose this poem because I've recently had a week in hospital for fairly major surgery. I love the way he presents the building as an enigma, something unsettling, something we need but fear having to use. I have to say that my view of hospitals is much more positive than Larkin's. People get mended much more often than they die in these places of care and safety and huge skill on the part of the doctors and nurses. But Larkin is using his subject to express our deep-seated and universal fear of death, together with his own sense of the futility and emptiness of the lives we cling to. As he sees it, conceits and self-protecting ignorance congeal to carry life. It's a pretty bleak view, but that he's able to express it so lyrically and with such technical skill and control is his poetic genius. After all, these are universal emotions, though one is not encouraged to express them too openly or too often. My favourite phrase in the whole poem is lucent comb, and I find the first four lines exquisite. The Building by Philip Larkin. Higher than the handsomest hotel, the lucent comb shows up for miles, but see all round it close-ribbed streets rise and fall like a great sigh out of the last century. The porters are scruffy. What keep drawing up at the entrance are not taxis. And in the hall, as well as creepers, hangs a frightening smell. There are paperbacks and tea at so much a cup, like an airport lounge. But those who tamely sit on rows of steel chairs, turning the ripped mags, haven't come far, more like a local bus. These outdoor clothes and half-filled shopping bags and faces restless and resigned, although every few minutes comes a kind of nurse to fetch someone away. The rest refit cups back to saucers, cough or glance below seats for dropped gloves or cards. Humans caught on ground curiously neutral, homes and names suddenly in abeyance. Some are young, some old, but most at that vague age that claims the end of choice, the last of hope, and all here to confess that something has gone wrong. It must be error of a serious sort, for see how many floors it needs, how tall it's grown by now, and how much money goes in trying to correct it. See the time, 11:30 on a working day, and these picked out of it. See, as they climb to their appointed levels, how their eyes go to each other, guessing. On the way, someone's wheeled past in washed to rags ward clothes. They see him too. They're quiet. To realise this new thing held in common makes them quiet. For past these doors are rooms, and rooms past those, and more rooms yet, each one further off and harder to return from. and who knows which he will see and when. For the moment, wait. Look down at the yard. Outside seems old enough. Red brick, lagged pipes, and someone walking by it out to the car park. Free. Then past the gate, traffic, a locked church, short terraced streets where kids chalk games and girls with hairdos fetch their separates from the cleaners. Oh, world, your loves, your chances are beyond the stretch of any hand from here. And so unreal, a touching dream to which we all are lulled, but wake from separately. In it, conceits and self-protecting ignorance congeal to carry life, collapsing only when called to these corridors. For now, once more, the nurse beckons. Each gets up and goes at last. Some will be out by lunch, or four. Others, not knowing it, have come to join the unseen congregations whose white rows lie set apart above. Women, men, old, young, crude facets of the only coin this place accepts, all know they are going to die. Not yet, perhaps not here, but in the end, and somewhere like this. That is what it means, this clean-sliced cliff. A struggle to transcend the thought of dying, for unless its powers outbuild cathedrals, nothing contravenes the coming dark, though crowds each evening try with wasteful, weak, propitiatory flowers.
Sunny Prestatyn.
Come to Sunny Prestatyn,
laughed the girl on the poster, kneeling up on the sand in tautened white satin. Behind her, a hunk of coast, a hotel with palms, seemed to expand from her thighs and spread breast-lifting arms. She was slapped up one day in March. A couple of weeks and her face was snaggletoothed and boss-eyed. Huge tits and a fissured crotch were scored well in, and the space between her legs held scrawls that set her fairly astride a tuberous cock and balls, autographed Titch Thomas, while someone had used a knife or something to stab right through the moustached lips of her smile. She was too good for this life. Very soon a transverse tear left only a hand and some blue. Now fight cancer is there.
Afternoons. Summer is fading. The leaves fall in ones and twos from trees bordering the new recreation ground. In the hollows of afternoons, young mothers assemble at swing and sandpit, setting free their children. Behind them, at intervals, stand husbands in skilled trades, an estate full of washing, and the albums lettered Our Wedding lying near the television. Before them, the wind is ruining their courting places. There are still courting places, but the lovers are all in school, and their children, so intent on finding more unripe acorns, expect to be taken home. Their beauty has thickened. Something is pushing them to the side of their own lives.
Mr. Bleeny, read by Martin Duckworth. I picked this poem because the dryly humorous way it tells a story and weaves in the description of a character living life on the margin of things. Mr. Bleeny.
This was Mr. Bleeny's room. He stayed the whole time he was at the bodies, till they moved him.
Flowered curtains, thin and frayed, fall to within 5 inches of the sill, whose window shows a strip of building land, tussocky, littered.
Mr. Bleeny took my bit of garden properly in hand.
Bed, upright chair, 60-watt bulb, no hook behind the door, no room for books or bags. I'll take it. So it happens that I lie where Mr. Bleeny lay, and stub my fags on the same saucer souvenir, and try stuffing my ears with cotton wool to drown the jabbering set he egged her on to buy. I know his habits, what time he came down, his preference for sauce to gravy, why he kept on plugging at the four aways, likewise their yearly frame, the Frinton folk who put him up for summer holidays, and Christmas at his sister's house in Stoke. But if he stood and watched the frigid wind tousling the clouds, lay on the fusty bed telling himself that this was home, and grinned and shivered without shaking off the dread that how we live measures our own nature, and at his age having no more to show than one hired box should make him pretty sure he warranted no better, I don't know.
Larkin is often considered the poet of doom and gloom, and of course we know that he's always round the corner in his poetry. But there's no true darkness without moments of light, and in the following poems, Larkin explores the role of love and compassion in our lives. Our readers for this section are Hans Rutten, Hugh Lester, Carmel Morgan, Laura Wilson, and HVP Anne Thwaite. Yuan Yu Zhang from King Henry VIII School, Coventry, gets us started.
The mower stalled twice. Kneeling, I found a hedgehog jammed up against the blades, killed. It had been in the long grass. I had seen it before, and even fed it once. Now, I had mauled its unobtrusive world unmendably. Burial was no help. Next morning, I got up, and it did not. The first day after a death, the new absence is always the same. We should be careful. Of each other, we should be kind, for there is still time.
Dear audience, first I must apologize for my English, as I am a Dutch national and not a native English speaker. I stumbled upon Larkin in the early 90s, when I was in my 30s. And looking for some holiday poetry in an English bookshop, not knowing then that the poems would become life companions. At the time, I understood only a few of them. Others opened up their meaning and beauty unexpectedly in later stages of life. They still help to unfold consciousness of myself and the world as I grow older. I've become very much attached to them, and they are very dear, as friends that know me well. In contrast with his popularity in Britain, in the Netherlands, Larkin is still a treasure of the literary elite. Some quotes from his poems show up in works of Dutch writers as a sign of literacy. The Dutch poet Eikelboom translated 30 poems back in 1983, when Larkin was still with us. But the copy I have secondhand has been removed from a local public library, where it was borrowed not a single time. In 2003, a selection of 21 poems was translated again by a Dutch high school teacher. And, to my surprise, last year, another high school teacher did all the poems from the three collections, trying to preserve meter, rhyme, and accents. It was privately published. I am glad that Larkin's poetry speaks to me in English. Some of my favorite verses have not yet been translated in Dutch, like the mower. But an April Sunday brings the snow has. I read this poem every time I want to recall what Proust calls temps perdu, time lost. It makes me aware how objects bring back feelings for people I have been with, because the objects were present themselves back then. I would like to read to you all this short poem in English and then in Dutch translation by Harry de Vries. Thank you for your attention, and thank you so much, Philip Larkin. An April Sunday brings the snow. An April Sunday brings the snow, making the blossom on the plum trees green, not white. An hour or two and it will go. Strange that I spend that hour moving between cupboard and cupboard, shifting the store of jam you made of fruit from these same trees. 5 loads. 100 pounds or more, more than enough for all next summer's teas, which now you will not sit and eat. Behind the glass, under the cellophane, remains your final summer, sweet and meaningless, and not to come again. Sneeuw valt op een zondag in april. Sneeuw valt op een zondag in april en maakt de pruimenbloesem groen, niet wit. Met een uur of twee is het weg. Het toeval wil dat ik die tijd met de verhuizing zit, van kast naar kast, van de voorraad door jou gemaakte jam uit fruit van diezelfde bomen. 5 partijen, 100 pond al gauw, meer dan genoeg om de hele zomer die gaat komen te serveren bij de thee, waar je niet meer aan meedoet. Achter het glas, onder het cellofaan, resteren jouw laatste zomerdagen, zinloos en zoet, en om niet meer terug te keren.
My name is Laura Wilson. I'm a Philip Larkin Society member and volunteer, and the poem I have chosen to read is Places, Loved Ones. This poem is one of my favourites as it epitomises Larkin's searingly honest attitude to love. I think it's easy to see his perspective as curmudgeonly and depressing, but for me, the way he questions whether finding that special someone would be an automatic guarantee of personal happiness is refreshing and courageous and very moving. Places, Loved Ones. No. I have never found the place where I could say, this is my proper ground, here I shall stay, nor met that special one who has an instant claim on everything I own down to my name. To find such seems to prove you want no choice in where to build or whom to love. You ask them to bear you off irrevocably, so that it's not your fault should the town turn dreary, the girl a dolt. Yet, having missed them, you're bound, nonetheless, to act as if what you settled for mashed you, in fact, and wiser to keep away from thinking you still might trace, uncalled for to this day, your person, your place.
My name is Hugh Lester. I have chosen Love Songs in Age from The Whitson Weddings, published in 1964. There are so many I could have chosen, but this has always been a favourite. It is beautifully constructed, with no word wasted or badly used. It describes a situation many will relate to and conveys a feeling we can all understand. It's profoundly moving, and the bleakness of its final message is tempered by Larkin's characteristic compassion. It is a very fine poem, I think. Love Songs in Age. She kept her songs. They took so little space. The covers pleased her. One bleached from lying in a sunny place, one marked in circles by a vase of water, one mended when a tidy fit had seized her, and coloured by her daughter. So they had waited till in widowhood she found them looking for something else, and stood relearning how each frank submissive chord had ushered in word after sprawling hyphenated word, and the unfailing sense of being young spread out like a spring-woken tree, wherein that hidden freshness sung, that certainty of time laid up in store as when she played them first. But even more, the glare of that much-mentioned brilliance, love, broke out to show its bright incipience sailing above, still promising to solve and satisfy and set unchangeably in order. So, to pile them back, to cry, was hard, without lamely admitting how it had not done so then, and could not now.
Born Yesterday, for Sally Amis. Tightly folded bud, I have wished you something none of the others would. Not the usual stuff about being beautiful or running off a spring of innocence and love. They will all wish you that, and should it prove possible, well, you're a lucky girl. But if it shouldn't, then may you be ordinary. Have, like other women, an average of talents. Not ugly, not good-looking. Nothing uncustomary to pull you off your balance. That, unworkable itself, stops all the rest from working. In fact, may you be dull, if that is what a skilled, vigilant, flexible, unemphasised, enthralled, catching of happiness is called.
Side by side, their faces blurred, the Earl and Countess lie in stone, their proper habits vaguely shown as jointed armour, stiffened pleat, and that faint hint of the absurd, the little dogs under their feet. Such plainness of the pre-Baroque hardly involves the eye, until it meets his left-hand gauntlet, still clasped empty in the other, and one sees, with a sharp, tender shock, his hand withdrawn, holding her hand. They would not think to lie so long. Such faithfulness in effigy was just a detail friends would see, a sculptor's sweet commissioned grace thrown off in helping to prolong the Latin names around the base. They would not guess how early in their supine stationary voyage the air would change to soundless damage, turn the old tenantry away, how soon succeeding eyes begin to look, not read. Rigidly they persisted, linked, through lengths and breadths of time. Snow fell, undated. Light each summer thronged the glass. A bright litter of bird calls strewed the same bone-riddled ground, and up the paths the endless altered people came, washing at their identity. Now, helpless in the hollow of an unarmorial age, a trough of smoke in slow suspended skeins above their scrap of history, only an attitude remains. Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their final blazon, and to prove our almost instinct almost true. What will survive of us is love.
Toads and cows feature in the next selection of poems, animals that don't have obviously human characteristics, but in Larkin's world represent something about the things we experience in life. Useful to get that learnt, as Larkin remarks. Thank you to Greg Walker, Kath Sked, Graham Chesters, Ingrid Keith and Tim Whitaker.
Hi, I'm Greg Walker in Falls Church, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Here's a Philip Larkin poem I've long admired. It's about experience. Wires. The widest prairies have electric fences. For though old cattle know they must not stray, young steers are always scenting purer water, not here, but anywhere. Beyond the wires leads them to blunder up against the wires, whose muscle-shredding violence gives no quarter. Young steers become old cattle from that day, electric limits to their widest senses.
Wild Oats.
About 20 years ago, two girls came in where I worked, a bosomy English rose and a friend in specs I could talk to. Faces in those days sparked the whole shooting match off, and I doubt if ever one had like hers. But it was the friend I took out, and in 7 years after that, wrote over 400 letters, gave a 10-guinea ring, I got back in the end, and met at numerous cathedral cities unknown to the clergy. I believe I met Beautiful twice. She was trying both times, so I thought not to laugh. Parting after about 5 rehearsals was an agreement that I was too selfish, withdrawn, and easily bored to love. Well, useful to get that learnt. In my wallet are still 2 snaps of bosomy rose with fur gloves on. Unlucky charms, perhaps.
My name is Tony Pizer. I live in Altadena, California. A friend of mine actually went to Westminster Abbey when Larkin got his stone in Poet's Corner and sent me the program that was distributed to all the attendees. It's the best present I ever got. Sadly, Philip never adjusted to his third act. Matisse, when he couldn't paint, used scissors. Dylan, if you listen to his last album, it sounds more like spoken word than singing. I'm sure Philip could have done something. But that's actually why this poem that I want to read is so wonderful, because he wrote it long after he said he couldn't write anymore. I also think part of the reason he wrote it is because one thing that he really did love was the library, which, even though I'm sure all the committee meetings and all that sort of bureaucratic stuff annoyed him, he knew that without it, he would have been, as he once said, a bag of bones years ago without steady employment. Library ode. New eyes each year find old books here, and new books too, old eyes renew. So youth and age, like ink and page, in this house join, minting new coin.
I'm Graham Chesters, and I'm the chair of the Philip Larkin Society. I would like to read what I think is Larkin's shortest poem, which has something of the haiku about it. This is the first thing I've understood. Time is the echo of an axe within a wood. The poem begins in the voice of an apprentice philosopher who feels delighted at having understood something, having unravelled some mystery of life. There's an excitement about that line. But what is it that he's understood? The aphorism that follows isn't immediately obvious in its meaning. Indeed, it seems to me something like a riddle, so that the promise of understanding, which is offered to the reader in the first part, becomes compromised by the mysteriousness of the metaphor that lies behind the second half. It feels as though the reader is challenged to unravel the meaning in much the same way as the apprentice philosopher has. So what begins as a declaration of clarity and understanding ends for the reader in something much more obscure and mysterious.
Hello, my name is Ingrid Keith, and I'm going to read Lines on a Young Lady's Photograph Album. It's a poem that I first encountered at school in the late 70s when we were studying The Less Deceived for A-level English. And I've chosen it because it reminds me of how keen a photographer Larkin was, and of the photo albums that people of my generation kept. And it makes me wonder what he would have made of digital photography and the way that everyone now manipulates images so that photos tell less of the truth than they have ever done before. And it makes me wonder whether he would have actually enjoyed that. Would he have been tempted, for example, to add a pair of bunny ears to an image of Monica? We'll never know. So, lines on a young lady's photograph album. At last, you yielded up the album, which once open, sent me distracted. All your ages, matte and glossy, on the thick black pages. Too much confectionery, too rich, I choke on such nutritious images. My swivel eye hungers from pose to pose. In pigtails, clutching a reluctant cat. Or furred yourself, a sweet girl graduate. Or lifting a heavy-headed rose beneath a trellis. Or in a trilby hat. Faintly disturbing that in several ways. From every side you strike at my control. Not least through these disquieting chaps who loll at ease about your earlier days. Not quite your class, I'd say, dear, on the whole. But oh, photography, as no art is, faithful and disappointing, that records dull days as dull and hold its smiles as frauds and will not censor blemishes like washing lines and hall's distemper boards, but shows the cat as disinclined and shades a chin as doubled when it is. What grace your candour thus confers upon her face. How overwhelmingly persuades that this is a real girl in a real place, in every sense empirically true. Or is it just the past? Those flowers, that gate, these misty parks and motors lacerate simply by being over. You contract my heart by looking out of date. Yes, true. But in the end, surely we cry not only at exclusion, but because it leaves us free to cry. We know what was won't call on us to justify our grief, however hard we yowl across the gap from eye to page. So I am left to mourn, without a chance of consequence, you, balanced on a bike against a fence. To wonder if you'd spot the theft of this one of you bathing. To condense, in short, a past that no one now can share, no matter who's your future. Calm and dry, it holds you like a heaven, and you lie invariably lovely there, smaller and clearer as the years go by.
I'm Tim Whittaker, a member of the Philip Larkin Society, and I'm currently researching and writing about Philip Larkin in his work as a librarian. The poem Toads Revisited explores Larkin's evolving attitude to work. He's one of the few poets who had a successful career and essentially wrote in his spare time. But Larkin had a love-hate relationship with the concept of work. His earlier poem Toads spelt out how work was a burden, squatting on his life and frustrating his literary endeavours. 9 years later, the sequel Toads Revisited came when Larkin was an established librarian at Hull, achieving great things. He now, perhaps reluctantly, concludes that although a drain on his time, work does give life a sense of purpose and importance. For me, this poem captures the contradictions that many of us may feel about work and career, which occupies such a great deal of our lives. Toads Revisited. Walking around in the park should feel better than work. The lake, the sunshine, the grass to lie on, blurred playground noises beyond black stocking nurses. Not a bad place to be, yet it doesn't suit me. Being one of the men you meet of an afternoon, pulsed old step takers, hair-eyed clerks with the jitters, waxed fleshed out patients still vague from accidents, and characters in long coats deep in the litter baskets, all dodging the toad work by being stupid or weak. Think of being them, hearing the hours chime, watching the bread delivered, the sun by clouds covered, the children going home. Think of being them, turning over their failures by some bed of lobelias. Nowhere to go but indoors. No friends but empty chairs. No, give me my in tray, my loaf-haired secretary, my... Shall I keep the call in, sir? What else can I answer when the lights come on at 4 at the end of another year? Give me your arm, old toad. Help me down Cemetery Road.
We end this birthday celebration podcast with poems that are, well, in my eyes anyway, celebrations. Trees, the seaside holiday, the glorious city of Hull, beauty in the everyday. Our readers are Polly McMullen again from King Henry VIII School, Casey Allen, Bert Molsom, Sally Button, Paul Evans, Lorna Symes, and rounding us off for today, Nick Smales.
The Trees by Philip Larkin, read by Polly, aged 12. Larkin went to my school, King Henry VIII, and I love nature, so this poem resonates. The trees. The trees are coming into leaf, like something almost being said. Their recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again and we grow old? No, they die too. Their yearly trick of looking new is written down in rings of grain. Yet still the unresting castles thresh in full-grown thickness every May. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Begin afresh, afresh, afresh.
To School in August by Philip Larkin. The cloakroom pegs are empty now and lock the classroom door. The hollow desks are lined with dust, and slow across the floor a sunbeam creeps between the chairs till the sun shines no more. Who did their hair before this glass? Who scratched Elaine Love's chill one drowsy summer sewing class? With scissors on the sill. Who practices piano, whose notes are now so still? Ah, notices are taken down, and scorebooks stowed away, and seniors grow tomorrow from the juniors today, and even swimming groups can fade, games mistresses turn grey.
My name is Bert Molsom, and I've chosen to read the poem Skin, which resonates with me as part of the aging process. Skin. Obedient daily dress. You cannot always keep that unfakeable young surface. You must learn your lines. Anger, amusement, sleep. Those few forbidding signs of the continuous, coarse, sand-laden wind. Time. You must thicken, work loose into an old bag carrying a soiled name. Parch, then. Be roughened. Sag. And pardon me that I could find, when you were new, no brash festivity to wear you at, such as clothes are entitled to, till the fashion changes.
Hello, I'm Sally Button, speaking to you from Nottingham. I first heard Philip Larkin's poem, To the Sea, on the Society's podcast in March this year, when Philip Pullen and Rachel Galletly discussed significant poems in his life, with this one evoking memories of childhood seaside holidays. It resonated for me as my parents moved to Coatham, Redcar, or Redcar to the locals, when I was a baby until the age of 6, and our house overlooked the sand dunes and sea. I walked along the beach regularly with my mum and dad as soon as I could toddle. They set up a lookout at the bottom of our garden with little steps and a seat so that I could watch the sea. So my choice of poem to read is To the Sea. To step over the low wall that divides road from concrete walk above the shore brings sharply back something known long before. The miniature gaiety of seasides. Everything crowds under the low horizon. Steep beach, blue water, towels, red bathing caps, the small hushed waves, repeated fresh collapse up the warm yellow sand, and further off, a white steamer stuck in the afternoon. Still going on, all of it, still going on. To lie, eat, sleep, in hearing of the surf, ears to transistors, that sound tame enough under the sky, or gently up and down lead the uncertain children, frilled in white and grasping at enormous air, or wheel the rigid old along for them to feel a final summer, plainly still occurs as half an annual pleasure, half a right. As when, happy at being on my own, I search the sand for famous cricketers, or, farther back, my parents, listeners to the same seaside quack first became known. Strange to it now, I watch the cloudless scene, the same clear water over smoothed pebbles, the distant bather's weak, protesting trebles down at its edge, and then the cheap cigars, the chocolate papers, tea leaves, and, between the rocks, the rusting soup tins, till the first few families start the trek back to the cars. The white steamer has gone. Like breathed on glass, the sunlight has turned milky. If the worst of flawless weather is our falling short, it may be that through habit these do best, coming to water clumsily undressed yearly, teaching their children by a sort of clowning, helping the old too, as they ought.
My name's Paul Evans, and the poem I'm going to read is called Coming. It was first published in the pamphlet 20 Poems, XX Poems, in 1951. And I've chosen it because it has some essential Larkin qualities. It's succinct, observant, and troubling. So here's the poem, Coming. On longer evenings, light, chill and yellow, bathes the serene foreheads of houses. A thrush sings, laurel surrounded in the deep bare garden, its fresh-peeled voice astonishing the brickwork. It will be spring soon. It will be spring soon. And I, whose childhood is a forgotten boredom, feel like a child who comes on a scene of adult reconciling and can understand nothing but the unusual laughter, and starts to be happy.
Hello, my name is Lorna Symes, and I am a freelance writer and broadcaster based in New Hampshire, in the northeast of the United States. For this special 99th birthday edition of Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin podcast, I've chosen to read my favourite of Larkin's poems, Is It For Now or For Always? I chose this particular piece because, to me, it's all about life, in all of its fragilities and uncertainties, but with an overriding feeling of optimism and a reminder to be present and appreciate life as it is, despite all its challenges. Is it for now or for always? Is it for now or for always? The world hangs on a stalk. Is it a trick or a trysting place, the woods we have found to walk? Is it a mirage or miracle, your lips that lift at mine? And the suns, like a juggler's juggling balls, are they a sham or a sign? Shine out, my sudden angel, break fear with breast and brow. I take you now and for always. for always is always now.
Here by Philip Larkin. Swerving east from rich industrial shadows and traffic all night north. Swerving through fields too thin and thistled to be called meadows. And now and then a harsh-named halt that shields workmen at dawn. Swerving to solitude of skies and scarecrows, haystacks, hares and pheasants. And the widening river's slow presence, the piled gold clouds, the shining gold-marked mud gathers to the surprise of a large town. Here, domes and statues, spires and cranes cluster beside grain-scattered streets, barge-crowded water, and residents from raw estates, brought down the dead straight miles by stealing flat-faced trolleys, push through plate glass swing doors to their desires. Cheap suits, red kitchenware, sharp shoes, iced lollies, electric mixers, toasters, washers, dryers. A cut-price crowd, urban yet simple, dwelling where only salesmen and relations come within a terminate and fishy-smelling pastoral of ships up streets, the slave museum, tattoo shops, consulates, grim, head-scarved wives. And out beyond its mortgaged, half-built edges, fast-shadowed wheat fields running high as hedges isolate villages, where removed lives loneliness clarifies. Here, silence stands like heat. Here, leaves unnoticed thicken, hidden weeds flower, neglected waters quicken, luminously peopled air ascends. And past the poppies, bluish neutral distance ends the land suddenly beyond the beach of shapes and shingle. Here is unfenced existence, facing the sun, untalkative, out of reach.
I hope you enjoyed this first part, and please join me in raising a glass, a beaker or a mug to Philip Larkin and thanking our readers and thanking Larkin himself for his wonderful poetry. If you want to keep the party going, then please head over to the Writing the School Is podcast, where Mr. James is also reading three great Larkin poems as a tribute. And we're looking forward to Mr. James joining us on a future episode of Tiny and All That Air. He's a great Larkin fan. I would also recommend his very original podcast that is all about memories of school days. It's an absolute delight. Also on the Twitter account, we have a reading of Friday Night in Station Hotel by Alan Johnson. And it's a lovely reading to watch, so I'd recommend you go over and have a look at that as well. This podcast was produced by Simon Galloway, and the opening music is The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. And the Mechanicals Band CD of the music that they set to Larkin poetry is now available to buy on our website, and it's fantastic. I'd really recommend checking it out. If you're enjoying the podcast, please sign up to the Philip Larkin Society newsletter. It's free. Or consider joining the Philip Larkin Society as a member. Our members' annual fee of £25 helps to fund the podcast, the journal, the website, the events, and we just would not be able to run without them. Look out for part two, and as ever, if you have any questions or suggestions, please get in touch.
The horns of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the cold.